Hello, folks, and happy Juneteenth, America's newest federal holiday, though I'm not quite sure really how much meaning making something a federal holiday actually has. But anyway, we're going to talk about Juneteenth. We're going to talk about the state of race relations in America, because that's a topic we love to just come back to over and over again. We will talk about criminal justice reform, because that's another topic we just love to come back to. Mostly because it's interesting. But before we get into all of that, I want to have a conversation about something a little bit deeper and more philosophical. And of course, Bianca will join us for some of, you know, whatever she has on her mind today. So I'm Patrick Cunningham, and this is Socratic Citizen. Okay, so, you know, I said I wanted to start with something a little bit more meditative. And the thing I want to start with is, sounds a little weird. It sounds a little unscientific. The Earth and the universe, if you ask me, is conscious, awake, a thing that thinks and is and has a sense of I am. Now, I don't know that this really qualifies as philosophy per se. Some people would call it spirituality instead. But I take the word philosophy literally, and the word philosophy literally means the love of wisdom. And in order to get wisdom, we have to pursue it. And to me, the pursuit of wisdom means the pursuit of truth. And so I try to pursue the truth as best I can. I don't claim to know a lot. In fact, I don't really have any degrees or any expertise. What I do have is an insatiable curiosity to know more. And frankly, that's why this show exists, is so I can kind of come on here and go, look at all this cool stuff I found. You should be as excited about this as I am. And, you know, then we go through life and we learn together and so on and so forth and build a beautiful, close relationship. But we'll talk about that some other time. For the time being, I want to talk about the awakeness of the universe, the aliveness of the universe, and the idea that we can think of the Earth itself as a kind of living organism. So, you could say that the universe is awake. And frankly, this is becoming less of a spiritual idea and more, dare I say, of a scientific idea. This is actually from Popular Mechanics here. Some scientists believe the universe is conscious. Is the universe a conscious being like a gigantic, widely dispersed human brain? Scientists have long questioned how consciousness and science mix. Two mathematicians have turned one theory into a crunchable math model. Now, I don't particularly care about the crunchable math model. What I do care about is this scientific debate, which really should more accurately be called a philosophical or even a spiritual debate, about the relationship between consciousness and the material world. Because if you ask people like Dan Dennett, who is a philosopher and consciousness researcher who's got some very good videos on YouTube about consciousness, though I think he fundamentally misunderstands what it actually is supposed to be. He is a materialist. He is a strong atheist, as opposed to a weak atheist. A strong atheist being one who positively asserts the non-existence of God, as opposed to a weak atheist who refuses to assent to the proposition there is a God. But I don't want to get into all of that right now. He is a strong atheist, what you might call a hardcore atheist. He falls in roughly the same camp as Sam Harris, though I think he's a little smarter than Sam. Poor Sam, he really doesn't get treated very well on this show. But anyway, if you ask somebody like Dan Dennett, he'll say, well, we know that consciousness arises from the structures of the brain. Whereas if you ask somebody of a more spiritual bent, they might say something like, and this is actually a real argument, no, the brain is not the seat of consciousness. The brain is more like a radio transmitter that, because it is tuned into a particular frequency, receives consciousness from somewhere else. In the case of most of these spiritual types, the place that it receives consciousness from is the universe as a whole. That the brain represents not a structure from which consciousness arises, but rather a place where it is concentrated. Consciousness, in this conception, is thought of as perhaps one of the primary elements of the universe. Matter, energy, and consciousness. were all what was brought into being when the universe began. And you could say things like, and this is a big favorite of mine, if a tree falls in the forest and there's no one there to hear it, there is neither tree nor forest. Because it is the conscious observer who divides the mess of matter and energy that is the universe into objects like tree and sound and falling. And is. And so we can get things like Bill Clinton's famous, depends on your definition of the word is. But again, that's a side route that I don't want to go down at the moment. For the time being, it's enough to say that it's not crazy to suggest that the universe might be awake. And I'm happy to take Dan Dennett where he is. I'm happy to start where the strong atheists, the people least likely to find anything worth listening to in an argument like the universe is awake and conscious, where they are, and say, okay, fair enough. Let's say that we can demonstrate that science can tell us that consciousness arises from the structures of the brain. That the brain is a complex set of what you might call electrical circuits, and the interaction of all those circuits, the decentralized system that is the brain, creates this sense of I am, this awakeness that's so difficult to define. Well, from that we can extrapolate that certain systems, if they're complex enough, can be awake. And so if we take Dan Dennett at his word, then the answer to the question, can a machine ever be conscious, is yes, a machine can be conscious. The problem is we don't really know where the line is. Like, let's say you were to hit me in the head with a sledgehammer, which would not be very nice, but I suppose you could do it. Perhaps I said something offensive on this show and you decided to wreak vengeance upon me by hitting me with a sledgehammer. And I lost 37 IQ points and, you know, became not the smartest dude in the world. We would not say, oh, you have ceased to be a conscious being. Even though my brain, in losing those IQ points, became a little bit less complex than it used to be. And indeed, if you have a dog that you love very much, it's really not that crazy to you to say, oh, my dog has feelings and emotions and a sense of self, and I have an emotional connection with this dog, and that emotional connection implies that there is someone home, that the lights are on and someone is home inside my dog, that my dog, in other words, is a conscious being. But a dog has a much lower IQ than I do. A dog certainly can't do any of the consciousness tests that people like Dan Dennett love to devise. And yet we assume, at least I do, that it's a conscious being. And then, of course, there's my favorite example, which is the example of the ants. And I just remember watching documentaries about ants and observing ants in my own environment here. There are quite a few ants here in northwestern Georgia. And I can't help but look at the behavior of ants and say, I feel like there's some awareness there. I feel like this is a being that's making decisions. And we've already established that a sufficiently complex system of interactions can produce awareness. So it's not so much of a stretch to say that my dog is aware. It's not so much of a stretch to say that an ant colony with all those millions of ants interacting with each other, it might itself be awake. So maybe it's the case that all sufficiently sophisticated systems produce some form of consciousness. But we still don't know how sophisticated a system has to be to produce consciousness. And then you talk to some of the Buddhists or some of the Taoists, people who believe that every object in the universe possesses at least a primitive form of consciousness. That rivers and rocks and trees and the earth itself are awake and alive. And so I like to say, well, if my brain is conscious and the universe contains many brains, the universe is indeed far more complex than my brain, then it's really not so much of a stretch to say that the universe itself is awake and alive and has consciousness. And then you go and you look at some of the things that go on in the universe, and it becomes even harder to say that we occupy some sort of dead material space, that the life of the human is some sort of rare spark defying the odds, and that with the death of each individual human and the death of the human race, we must, as Dylan Thomas said, rage against the dying of the light. On the contrary, Dylan, there is no dying of the light, because everything is the light. And so I want to move to something else and talk about this. This is, to me, the best evidence of the sort of thing I'm talking about. This is from undark.org, and it is a book review of a book called The Wood Wide Web of Plant Communication. Oh, no, actually, the book is called Finding the Mother Tree, Discovering the Wisdom of the Forest, which is about the hippiest thing I've ever heard. But The Wood Wide Web of Plant Communication is what I want to talk about for the time being, and how this kind of leads to this conception of a wholeness to the universe. Hello, Spank and That Monkey. Welcome to the stream. I will read comments in a moment, but let me get to the end of my little spiritual meditation here, and then we're going to talk about that a little bit later in the show. That's one of our topics for today, though I didn't phrase it quite that way. We'll get there, Spank and the Monkey. Just bide your time. So imagine, the article says, being a world-class scientist whose work was immortalized in James Cameron's movie Avatar. Remember the trees talk to each other in Avatar? Others have written about her research, including Peter Wallaben in The Hidden Life of Trees. And she writes about finding the mother tree, discovering the wisdom of the forest. It's all about trees being able to talk to each other and how they share information. And when Bianca comes on, we're going to talk about a mold, a slime mold called Physarum polycephalum that does exactly the same thing. And then I see things like this. This is a video that I found that's very cool about a relationship between an octopus and a random woman. And the octopus here is trying to move this log. And the woman has come to visit her octopus friend. And he tries to get her to help him move the log. He keeps putting her finger on the log. And as she pushes the log, he darts underneath it and grabs shells from underneath the log. So he convinced her to help him grab these shells from under this log. And as it turns out, there is actually a bill in England, in the UK, to consider octopuses and lobsters as beings with feelings, and they should be included in an animal sentience bill, saying basically that these creatures are awake. They are sentient. They are conscious beings. And an octopus, obviously, is a non-social creature. They don't build cities. They don't live in communities. They are solo. They're flying solo all the time. Though I would be willing to bet that if they were social creatures, we might have some competition for dominance of the planet. But what does all this mean? What is the point of all of this? The point is, well, I might sound a little bit like a hippie right now. I'll protect the octopuses and save the trees and don't destroy the forest and so on and so forth. And this is where, Spank and the Monkey, we start to kind of move from talking about really airy fairy spiritual stuff to talking about something with a little more significance in human society. Because although I think octopuses are really intelligent, I don't suggest that people should not eat them. I don't think it should be illegal to eat octopuses. I also don't get too incensed about deforestation or the destruction of the environment or anything like that, or climate change. Now, that's not to say I'm going to sit here and dispute science on climate change and say, oh, it's not real, it's made up, whatever. I frankly don't care if it's made up or not. It really doesn't make any difference. Because what I know comes from Epictetus, the ancient Roman philosopher. And Epictetus made a point in one of his discourses. He said, if you think of my hand just as a hand, just, you know, my hand, hello, and you think of this as its own separate thing, then it is right, by the standards of just my hand, that it should be clean, the nails should be well taken care of and cut, and it should never be dirty or calloused or have to receive cuts or anything like that. But if you think of my hand as a member of a larger body, the rest of me, then it is right that in service to the larger body, the hand should be cut or dirty or unclean or whatever. And so I, as an individual person, considered by myself, it is right that I should never suffer or be sick, that I should grow to an old age and die comfortably in my bed, surrounded by loving relatives. But if I am to be considered part of a larger whole, then it is right that I should die in battle. It is right that I should be sick. It is right that I should suffer and there should be unfairnesses in my life. Because we're not just considering the individual person. We're considering the larger viewpoint. And so while it's the coolest thing in the world that trees are able to talk to each other, and while it's the coolest thing in the world that octopuses are intelligent and they can interact and form friendships with human beings, at least that's what it looks like they're doing, as cool as it is that dogs and humans can share the deep emotional connection that they do, when we consider the larger picture, when we consider the whole picture, when we consider octopuses and trees and humans and dogs as all part of something larger, which is the great conscious being called the Earth, which is itself part of a much larger conscious being called the universe, it is right that some people should die young. It is right that some octopuses should be eaten. It is right that some forests will be cut down. Or even that human advancement will result in the complete reorganization of society. Or, excuse me, not of society. That human society should result in the complete reorganization of the Earth's environment. We don't know what comes. When the Earth warms, the average temperature on the Earth warms up by 5 or 6 degrees Celsius, and the equator becomes an uninhabitable place for human beings, and sea levels rise. Sure, all the stuff that existed when we got here may be gone. We may precipitate the largest mass extinction event in Earth's history. But what comes after that? We really don't know. We can't really predict. I mean, hey, we still can't predict the weather, much less what'll happen a million years from now. Even if we do completely fail to control ourselves and we eat every last resource on the planet and humans go extinct, who knows what comes after that? But considered with the larger, considered by the standards of the larger whole, it is right that humanity will go extinct one day. And so I'm not particularly interested in, for example, using the force of government to protect forests or octopuses or anything like that. I'm disappointed to see those things go away. But I'm also disappointed when my friends die. It doesn't mean that it's somehow wrong that people die. Even untimely deaths. There's a story in the Zhuangzi, which is Zhuangzi's book of Taoist wisdom. He's the second great Taoist philosopher after Lao Tzu. And he tells a story in his book about the death of the great master, Lao Tzu. And all of his disciples were sitting around and crying and sobbing and, oh my God, I can't believe he's gone. But then the one wisest disciple came, cried a little bit, and turned to leave. And the other disciples stopped him and they said, well, hold on a second here. Didn't you love the master? Why aren't you more upset? And the greatest of Lao Tzu's disciples said, he came into the world when the time was right, and he left the world when the time is right. Not being attached to that particular form allows me to take my sadness in stride, to be disappointed that he is gone, but not to fret over much about it. And that's the same attitude I think we should take for everything. Things come when they're supposed to and they go when they're supposed to. And we are part of that. We are not separate from nature. We are not the overlords of nature. We are part of nature. And so things, octopuses and dogs and humans and trees that talk to each other come into the world when they're supposed to come into the world and they leave the world when they're supposed to leave the world. And what we should do is be what we are, which is human mammals, and not try to be something greater than what we are. And it's just as unenlightened for us to point guns at people and demand that they only cut down these trees over here and not those trees over there, as it is to go around with chainsaws and cut down all the trees. Because we really can't be enlightened, because we are what we are. As Lao Tzu said, what is a bad man? but a good man's teacher. No one ever became wise without first being unwise. And indeed, if someone did, then their wisdom is worthless. It's just pointless. It's just, oh, that's just the way they are. Wisdom has value because it's achieved. Enlightenment has value because it is sought after. Not because it's given. What would be the point of that? And so, for example, we want to say, oh, we're going to go and we're going to fight against evil. We're going to eradicate evil from the world. And somehow that will make the world a better place. Somehow I am going to go and do something to the world. And then the world is going to be better. But this is a very silly idea. And Zhuangzi actually talks about this. He tells another story. The story of a young sage, or a training sage, you might say, who went to his master and said, listen, in the next province over, there is a prince who is absolutely profligate. He is murderous, and he has a thin skin, and he takes vengeance on people, and he is just not living according to the way of nature. And what I would like to do, oh master, is go over to that province and reform him. And I will bring him into the following the Tao, and the world will be a better place as a result of me doing this. And the great old master said to him, you cannot accomplish that. You can try, but you're going to fail. Because as long as it's in your heart to go around and try and fix him, you yourself are not living in the way of nature. You yourself are already trying to go out there and control the world, but you're not supposed to control the world. The way of nature itself controls the world. Your job is just to be in it. So if you want to reform this prince, then do this. Stop worrying about reforming him. Reform yourself and live well. Live an enlightened life. Go move in next door to him and just live an enlightened life. And if he wants to do the same, he will join you. And that, his freely choosing, is part of the way of nature. You trying to control his behavior, you trying to persuade and convince him is not. That's you trying to be in control. That is you literally having hubris, literally arrogance before the gods. Literally going to the gods or Tao or Mirth Mother Gaia or God or whatever you want to call it and saying, I can do your job for you. I can do it better than you can. But to quote another spiritual teacher I know of, I don't know him, but he said, you know not why a thing occurs, nor to what end. So we really don't know why a thing occurs. Because most of the time, I'm not considering the whole. Most of the time, I'm considering me. And me considering me is like the hand just considering the hand. The hand just considering the hand thinks, I should always be clean. My nails should always be perfect. I should never get cuts or calluses or have to do any hard work because it's painful. But I, considering the whole of the body, say, no, you are a hand and you are part of something larger than yourself. And as a result, it may not make sense to you, but it is right that sometimes you should suffer. There's another story I want to talk about very briefly, and that is, it comes to us from... actually, Psychology Today. It's an interview with this guy, Rick McIntyre, who wrote one of the most interesting stories that I think I've ever heard about Wolf 21 in Yellowstone Park. And Wolf 21 is called the Batman of Wolves. He never lost a fight. Indeed, he fought off six other wolves at one point, but he also never killed a wolf he defeated, which is very rare among wolves. Most wolves kill their opponents when they win. He didn't do this. He's also one of the few wolves ever to die of old age, rather than in combat. He lived 9 years, twice the lifetime of a normal wolf, and one day he woke up, walked away from the pack, climbed up onto a hill, laid down next to a tree, and died. And apparently he knew he was dying, because he went off by himself to do it. But this is very rare among wolves, and we celebrate this wolf. This is the coolest wolf ever. How exciting is this? He's like Batman and Jesus and Buddha all wrapped into one in wolf form. That's amazing. But what if every wolf died of old age? What if every wolf was merciful and kind and benevolent? Then this wolf would be meaningless. What if every Achilles died of old age? What if Jimi Hendrix had lived long enough to sell out and not died too young. Indeed, we even look at somebody like George Floyd and say he died an untimely death at the hands of police. But suppose that his death saves, he becomes some sort of rallying cry, and his death ends up saving millions of other people from injustice and suffering and early death. If that's really the case, was his death so untimely? Or did it perhaps come at the exact right time? All right, let's take a look at the chat here. So, I know Spankin' Monkey, whatever your name is, says, why do so many blacks not have fathers? I sense a little animus here, Monkey Spanker. Well, we are going to talk about fatherlessness, as I pointed out in the title of this episode. Actually, interestingly enough, that Wolf 21 was raised by a foster father. His biological father died or something, and his little wolf pack was taken over by somebody else, a wolf called 8. And the wolf 8 raised all of the pups in the pack as if they were his own. And the park ranger, this Rick McIntyre guy, says that he believes that 21, as a young wolf, saw his father, his foster father, Wolf 8, win a fight and not kill the other wolf. Which 21, that's what 21 did throughout his whole life. And the park ranger says he learned that behavior from his foster father. So fatherlessness is going to be a theme here when we get into like the political topics. Spankin' the Monkey, when you watch this show for a while, you'll recognize we do a 30-minute meditation before we really get into the topics at hand. So anyway, Juneteenth, Spankin' the Monkey says, is a fake liberal holiday to demonize the white man. Well, interestingly enough, Spank the Monkey, I can't speak to what the political ramifications of Juneteenth as a federal holiday will be. What I can say with, in fact, a pretty significant degree of confidence is that Juneteenth actually represents a fantastic instance of the so-called white man actually living up to the principles in the Declaration of Independence. Actually living up to the vision behind the Constitution of a society in which people actually are all treated equally by the law. We wrote in the Declaration of Independence that all men are created equal, and yet there was this glaring instance in which we did not live up to it. And that glaring instance was slavery. But hey, ultimately, we fixed the problem. And Juneteenth, even though it's not the day that the Emancipation Proclamation came out, Juneteenth is a celebration of that. Juneteenth is the day that we say, hey, we were screwing up royally, especially as a people who proclaim that we believe in freedom and justice and equality before the law. We started practicing our principles like way better when we ended slavery. And maybe there will be, as you say, liberals who want to demonize the white man who will use Juneteenth for that purpose. But that's not the real meaning of it. That's like complaining that Christmas is commercialized and it's just a way for the evil capitalist overlords to sell us electronic toys. That's not the real meaning of Christmas. It's not the real meaning of Juneteenth. Because the end of slavery was a victory for humankind. Most of human history had slavery in it. We managed, in the second half of the 19th century, to fix that problem. And sure, things are not perfect now, but they're a hell of a lot better than they used to be. And so for that reason, I actually like Juneteenth as a holiday. And I see no reason to demonize anybody, because everything got better. The white man started living up to his principles. The black man got to not be a slave anymore. That to me sounds like the biggest win-win you could possibly imagine. And I'm all about economics and free markets and all of that stuff. You can't be like that and excuse slavery or try to minimize slavery because you're worried about what some Democrats are going to use it for, right? Politicians are going to make the worst they possibly can out of everything. So let's please not decide what holidays are good and what holidays are bad based on what politicians choose to do with them. So SC says, we boil lobsters live. They know what's happening and it's just awful. Can't imagine how that feels. Well, you know, it's about 90 degrees outside today, so I imagine it feels like that, but worse. Yeah. Boiling lobsters alive is not very nice, certainly. But that doesn't really change the broader picture. That considered as a whole, it is proper and expected, and it's what's going to happen, that some creatures, some conscious entities are going to suffer. Just like it's right that my finger should suffer when I accidentally cut it while I'm slicing up the tomatoes to go with that lobster I'm boiling. My hand suffers on behalf of the whole. And then SC says, we do know some of these queries from people who have experienced NDEs, near-death experiences. I don't know what you mean by queries. You talking about knowing what happens after death? Well, the problem with that is, and we're going to do Bianca right after this, but the problem with that is that very often, and this is something that's common to mystical experience, like Gershom Scholem wrote about this in his seminal textbook on the Kabbalah, Jewish mysticism. He talks about how the tension between the religionist and the mystic is that the mystic is engaging in practices that lead to direct apprehension of God. I have a direct connection with the divine everything, the great I am, as the Old Testament says. But then when he comes back into the world and he wants to tell other people about his experiences, he has to find a way to put them in terms that those people will understand. And that's where the religionist comes in. With the elaborate mythologies and the rules of behavior and so on and so forth, he takes what the mystic does and turns it into something that other people can apply in daily life. Because most of us are just not going to have the time or the energy to be able to climb up on a mountain for 6 days and not eat and spend all our time watching the clouds go by waiting for God to speak to us. So we let the professional mystics do that. And instead, we take their wisdom and turn it into something we can understand. And so the same thing with NDEs. While I'm there, I can be having all these tremendous experiences, but when I come back to the world, I have to put them in some kind of terms that people will understand. And very often that means saying, instead of blah, 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 because it's an ineffable experience, instead I say, oh, I saw Jesus. SC says, I know nothing. Upside down smiley face. Yes, I too know that I know nothing. You've clearly been watching this show for a while. And then hello, Truthway, and welcome to the stream. And I promise we're going to do the Bianca segment after this. In all religions, there is an exoteric interpretation for the masses and an esoteric mystical one for those who look. Yes, absolutely. But the reason that that is that way is that most of us, most of the time, are not professional philosophers. We're not professional mystics. We got to get up and go to work and do stuff in our own lives. And we just can't be bothered with mysticism. Or maybe we're just not into it. Maybe we love technology and we love building bridges and we don't really want to go meditate for 12 hours. So we just let the mystics take care of that. And they teach us normal, ant people what the rights and the simple right and wrong stuff is. But of course, I always want to know the esoteric, mystical everything.